The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra International Break European Championship Qualifiers Special. We'll look ahead to the home nation's chances and the other big sides with representatives from within the EU, outside the EU, and maybe in or out, probably out, who the hell knows, but we're stockpiling bog roll just in case. Elsewhere, big changes to the Champions League, big money for the WSL, footballers who should probably close down their Instagrams, mic'd up refs and stag dudes. All that, plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Ellis James, nice to see you.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm really well, it's lovely to have you on. Are you over the Manchester City game yet?
Do you know what? I love Danny Baker's VAR Twitter outbursts until it happens to your club, and then he's wrong. When he's talking about VAR in general and being quite unreconstructed in the 1970s about it, I think, I love this, Danny. You're a man of the people. But when it happens to you in the FA Cup and you were 21 minutes from Wembley, then yeah, it can be pretty frustrating, actually.
Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
Norway plus plus with us in the room today.
That's harsh, but fair enough.
And the exciting moment today was, we all know that Barry has his chair, but Ellis put his stuff at that chair over
there,
you made a face, and then you moved
and
his cycle helmet.
I also made a sound like a startled crow or something that was, I don't want to repeat it, but yeah. No, I have been in the same chair every single pod I've been in, and I figured Ellis has also been in this chair, he says, but then he has presented, in which case he was in your chair, Max, so he has already shown a certain versatility, and I thought it was more logical for him to move than for me to move.
Also, I'm not a Libra. But I should be, really, because I just want us all to get on. And if you need to sit in that chair, Lars, you carry on.
I just didn't think this was the pod to find out. You know, it's International Week. Yeah. It's a tough one as it is.
Barry, hi.
Hello.
Have you seen, obviously there's a lot in the news about Brexit, so most people, or some people may have missed this story about Lorraine Kelly winning a massive legal case over unpaid tax by arguing she does not appear on TV as herself, but instead as an actor playing a cheery, upbeat character called Lorraine Kelly. Barry, is the reverse true of you, and is this a tax scam?
I believe those tax payments related to payments she made to an agent. I don't pay an agent.
Okay.
You know,
but off air,
I'm one of those broadcasters, you know, who gets my dad to do all my negotiations.
Putting on a voice.
It's a clever ruse on Lorraine's part, and I fully expect lots of other people who are just playing a role at work to now try and do tax dodges. For example, you know, feigning interest in a Europa League. I go to work and play the part of someone feigning interest in a Europa League fixture between Arsenal and Rennes.
Anyway, here's a question from Rob saying, in terms of quality fixtures, is this the worst international break there has ever been? I've scanned through, Lars. Belgium, Russia, Holland, Germany. On Monday, you've got Portugal, Serbia and France, Iceland. Tuesday, you've got Norway, Sweden. There's some decent games there, aren't there?
In terms of intrigue, certainly, the Holland-Germany one is big, just given how much the Netherlands just gave the Germans some tonking in the Nations League and putting Jogi Löw under further pressure, and him having now ousted some of the old guard. He's under real pressure to get a kind of result there. And the Netherlands are, of course, resurgent. Glad you mentioned Norway-Sweden. That is very much the big one in that group, because we're kind of expecting the Spanish to sort of maul us all. So it's between us and Sweden and Romania, I think, to get the second qualification spot. So it's a huge game in that group already in this first break.
Who's better, you or Sweden?
Sweden are probably marginally better, but they're not, or quite a lot better, really. But they're not, when you look at their team sheet, it doesn't give you the shakes. You know, you think this is a team on a good day you can get something from.
Well, let's start with Wales, shall we? Because they played yesterday. They've got a qualifier against Slovakia on Sunday. They've got Hungary, Croatia, Azerbaijan in the group as well. And you hammered Trinidad and Tobago, Ellis, last night.
Yeah. First game of the race course for 10 years. It was a second 11. In terms of a sort of attacking players and sort of players to get excited about, the whole idea of the fixture was to give people like Ashley Williams and Gunter and Woodburn important minutes because they haven't been playing for their clubs. Obvious, it was a very poor game. The standard was very poor. A lot of people were upset because it was such a second 11 because, you know, we haven't played in North Wales for a long time. That said, We've always been rubbish at friendlies. That's not the point of a friendly, is to give a good account of yourself against Trinidad and Tobago, who are, I think, 93rd in the world. So I don't really see what the fuss is about. The fact is, it was Ryan Giggs' 10th game in charge, and he's been quite difficult to read as a manager because he's given 11 debuts and he's played in lots of different formations. We've had some cracking results. We're very good against the Irish, very good against China. And that really matters very much. I thought we looked second best against Denmark both times in the Nations League. We're not really sure of what Ryan Giggs' first 11 is. I met him last week and he reckons that he knows 10 of his first 11. Now,
when you say you met him, it was an interview. It wasn't
I didn't bump into him. I didn't doorstep him like Roger Cook. That's a reference from like 25 years ago. And the thing I found quite impressive with Ryan Giggs when I interviewed him last week was suddenly a plan has started to emerge, because he talked about almost qualifying for USA 94 under Terry Orath. That was a good team with Rush and Hughes and Southall. And almost qualifying for Euro 2004 under Mark Hughes. And the point he was making was, in those days, and this is also true of Coleman's reign, it was very obvious who our first 11 was. And A, if we got a couple of injuries or suspensions, we were in big trouble. And also, it's in the era of the international doubleheader, it's quite hard to raise your game twice in a few days if you're playing the same 11 players. So the fact he's given all these debuts to players I have had to Google, some of whom don't have Wikipedia pages. The reason he's been doing it is that he's just desperately trying to expand the talent pool and also to increase competition in the squad. Because then the point he made was, when we came very close to qualifying for Euro 2004, we had a playoff against Russia. I don't know if you remember this, but we drew out in Moscow, and they hadn't lost in Moscow for 25 years. So it was a great result, 0-0. You're thinking, right, just got to beat them in Cardiff. Just got to beat them in Cardiff. And he said, we were shattered. It was the same first 11. We were just knackered. I mean, one of their players got done for performance-enhancing drugs, but still.
So he was less knackered.
Yeah, absolutely. But so suddenly, the way he was talking about, team shape and stuff, he appeared to have more of a plan than I had given him credit for in the previous games. He's in quite a strange situation in that a lot of friendlies, the China Cup and also the Nations League, has effectively given him a 12-month, 9-game free hit. So we're playing Slovakia on Sunday. That's the big one. If it doesn't work out on Sunday, I'll get worried. But until then, I am not quietly confident. I am quietly fine.
Ellis, anything other than second in this group, I would say for Wales would be failure. A failure for Giggs. Because I remember listening to your Feast of Football podcast, where people can listen to the Giggsy interview, which is very good. You, Gabs, and Owen Roberts.
Owen Roberts, yeah.
After Wales demolished Ireland.
Yes.
I just thought you were getting so carried away with yourselves. Because I was aware of the absolute dross you had just played, rings around. And I remember listening to that, having a little chuckle going, those boys are way ahead of themselves here.
The interesting thing he's done is that under Coleman, we occasionally often lacked imagination going forward, but we were very difficult to beat. So we lost to Ireland and failed to get a playoff for Russia 2018. Back in 2017, we lost 1-0 when Joe Allen was concussed. And that Coleman team, we just didn't have enough to break down a very disciplined Ireland side. Now, what Giggs has done is we're far more exciting going forward. We've got this glut of talent out wide. We've got players like Harry Wilson and Tom Lawrence and Ben Woodburn and David Brooks and Dan James, are playing very well for Swansea. We don't really have a number nine, but I think I foresee Gareth Bale doing that as he gets older. So we can be very good. I was actually more impressed with the win out in Dublin, because we didn't have Bale and Ramsey in the team so for the first time since 2008. And those are the games we've always lost. However, we were disappointing against Denmark. We can be very good going forward. We seem to be worse at the back now. If you look at Denmark, for example, they are difficult to beat. That's their foundation. They're a country of a very similar size to Wales. You think, surely that's the model, rather than this swashbuckling.
Oh, I like a swashbuckling minnow. It's
buccaneering football that Giggs seemingly wants to play.
But that's kind of international football, though. You are at the mercy of the players you happen to have available in any given year. So but if you have good attackers, then that's what you have.
But we were very disciplined under Coleman, and we very rarely conceded. So we, you know, when we qualified for Euro 2016, we only scored 11 goals, I think. We were winning games 1-0.
But how much is that to do with someone like Ashley Williams still being good at that point?
Well, I mean, obviously there is a lot of that. So now a lot of pressure's been put on players like Mepham and Ben Davis.
I say this as someone who's also from quite a small country, so I have experience with if there's one player at your international team who suddenly ages quite a bit, then the thing you were doing doesn't work at all anymore.
Who suddenly got old for you?
I know there was a while. There was a while when John Carew was kind of carrying the team on his own a little bit, and then suddenly he got old real fast, and it was.
And then he
so
became a movie star. He's an incredibly
Indeed.
Cool man.
Yeah,
isn't
he's
he?
Good.
Well, Giggs also seems obsessed with it with youth. So I haven't had time to work out what the average age of the first 11 was last night, but the squad he announced last week for the game against Trinidad and Tobago and Slovakia on Sunday, the average age was 24. And Ashley Williams would have quite wildly, you know, disorientated that statistic. He does seem obsessed with playing very young players. He'll often play Tyler Roberts instead of Sam Vokes, even though Sam Vokes against Denmark, Sam Vokes was still playing well in the Premier League and scoring goals for Burnley. You think, come on, Ryan. I mean, I know he's 28. It's not that old.
Come on, granddad. Exactly. A fun fact, it was a return to Wrexham for Trinidad and Tobago manager Dennis Lawrence, who played for them between 2001 and 2006. He was offered the Wrexham job in December, but chose to stay in charge of Trinidad and Tobago. He got 89 caps for them. A tough decision between the climes of the Caribbean and a North Welsh winter.
Well, you know, I'm sure he thinks of his time at the racecourse very fondly. They're on their third manager this season, but they're currently, I think, third in the National League.
So that league is so ridiculously tight.
Well, no one wants to win it.
No.
So you'll be top for a couple of games and then you'll lose three games in the trot. But that won't really adversely affect your chances.
Kabina writes, James Woodburn, Lawrence Roberts, Wilson, destined to be top-level stars or Welsh Nugent, Gale, peak championship-level type players?
I think there's a very good player in Dan James. I think David Brooks, it'll probably be Marcus Rashford, but he should be on the shortlist for Young Player of the Year. I think he's been superb this year for Bournemouth. And I think Harry Wilson's an excellent player. I got a very giddy text from a friend of mine called Paul, who's a Derby County fan. And Wilson's got a cracking free kick before Christmas, and he just texted me and said, he's going to win you the World Cup. This guy is incredible.
That's right. That's what you need is more hope.
I was very pleased that Ben Woodburn got a lot of minutes under his belt. He played the full 90 and scored yesterday, because it's easy to forget that a year ago he was the bright young thing. He's got that cracking goal against Austria. We beat Moldova 2-0, and he set up Hal Robson-Kanu's header by running from his own half. And, you know, especially the goal against Austria, it was sort of Roy of the Rovers stuff. But he went out to Sheffield United. He didn't play. He put on weight. I think his confidence has taken a knock. But when I talked to Ryan, he spoke so fondly of Ben Woodburn and said that in training he's incredible. He just needs an arm around the shoulder at club level,
and not another biscuit or something. Whenever you hear about a player putting on weight, in your mind you go, "There's sort of balloon." Like,
well, he's living
stone,
in a hotel.
Oh, is he?
So I think
that's
he's probably
with the breakfast. And all
He's basically living a stand-up comics diet. Surface dishes.
Let's move on to England then. Qualifiers against the Czech Republic on Friday, Montenegro on Monday, Bulgaria and Kosovo also in Group A. And Barry, basically every single photo you see is of just young men getting along and smiling. It's such a happy camp, England, isn't it?
It seems to be the days of the England camp being riven with cliques of Manchester United players in one corner, Liverpool players in another, and, you know, various other players in a third, you know, all not being very nice to each other, seem to be completely over. Seems a very happy camp. That was abundantly clear during the World Cup. They're way more media friendly, which is an innovation of Gareth Southgate's, which the players seem to enjoy. They seem to enjoy talking to the media. And, you know, that's a group they should walk, no problem.
John Stones, Fabian Delph, Luke Shaw, Ruben Loftus-Cheek have all pulled out of injuries. Trent Alexander-Arnold pulled out yesterday. Wan-Bissaka has not been brought in. They've still got Kyle Walker and Kieran Trippier at right back. Hudson-Odoi and James Ward-Prowse brought into the squad. A nice story about Hudson-Odoi thinking it was a joke and getting a lift to Bristol to the under-21s and then getting a call and then having to go up to Burton and a chance for the newspapers to print maps of how to get there quickly on Google Maps and how long his journey was.
It reminded me of Des Walker desperately watching the England squad being announced on CFAX, hoping to be in it. And he thinks, surely you don't find out on CFAX if you're in the England squad.
Well, I heard, we interviewed a lot of people, you know, players who make the squad, and it used to be Michelle from the FA would call you. And that's how you'd find out, is getting a call from Michelle. But I don't know if Michelle is
what a lovely
still
job
there.
For Michelle.
Yeah, I know. It's like it's the reverse job of the woman who sends people into the boardroom in The Apprentice.
Yeah. But maybe if Hudson-Odoi had seen it on CFAX, he would have realised that it wasn't a joke. So maybe actually this is a more reliable method of informing them
than AD Boothroyd. Yeah. You're right.
You've got to get the CFAX in.
John Stones pulling out, I guess, is the only one who would definitely have started. Trent Alexander-Arnold, I suppose you could say. So it could mean that Michael Keane starts at centre-back, and he's not sort of blown anyone away this year.
It probably doesn't need to at home against the Czech Republic. I think they're not in a great way, the Czechs, so I would expect England to win that quite comfortably. Beyond that, I think as someone who's fairly neutral here, I'm quite excited to the potential of seeing a sort of a Sterling, Kane and Sancho front three. I mean, whether you're an England fan or not, that is a very, very exciting attacking trio to see. I mean, Sancho is so exciting. I mean, for people who don't watch the Bundesliga regularly, he's been just really outstanding, and Sterling is magnificent. That'll be fun to watch.
Rashford's nursing an ankle injury, so that may give Sancho the chance to start.
Also, the possibility of Ireland's young player of the year making his debut is exciting for everyone, I think.
Do you think he will start? It's interesting, Declan Rice, isn't it? Because he does appear to have a bit more about him as a holding midfielder than the other holding midfielders in the squad.
Well, I think the one thing he does bring about, he's more direct. He gets the balls forward quickly. I think he has to get it some minutes, because who's to say he won't change his mind again if he doesn't and decide to declare, oh, I've had a rethink and I want to go back
to
Ireland.
Country he could play for?
Well, he could go back to Ireland, I suppose. Not that we'd have him. Geet.
The dual nationality thing has overshadowed how good a player he is, actually. I think he's a very exciting prospect, Declan Rice. It is, I mean, in fairness, a huge amount of footballers now have dual nationality.
Yeah.
So this is, he's probably the first of these examples. But this kind of thing will happen again and again and again.
There's a piece by Barney Ronay in the paper today quoting Dan Ashworth, saying of 75 under-15s on England's radar, 55 are eligible for more than one country. Yeah. And Dan Ashworth says, we cannot be arrogant enough to assume that if a kid's living here, he automatically wants to play for England.
You know, you carry on, Barry.
But just Michael Keane, who we were talking about, is the case in point. And he switched allegiance after playing underage level for the Irish, and, you know, openly admits it was because at the time he was happy to play for them because he wasn't good enough to play for England or get picked for England.
There's also, I think that's the cynical approach that a lot of fans accuse these young players of taking. I think it is certainly now more, it is more complex than that. And, you know, Declan Rice, it was his grandparents are from Cork, aren't they? It can completely depend on the relationship you have with your grandparents. You know, he might well have felt very Irish. He might well have not. You have to take it on a case-by-case basis. The Republic of Ireland team under Jack Charlton, I mean, as Welsh fans, we were amazed at how many Anglos they had in their side. But that is the Irish story, because Ireland is a country of economic migrants. I'm looking at one. it was very rare in the Welsh setup until very recently, and now it happens more and more. I just think that in 10 years' time, the furore around Declan Rice will be, you know, laughable.
But the thing is, you've said there he's a prospect and he's 20. it could still go either way for him career wise. So.
Via Walcott style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, or worse, who's to say? But, you know, he clearly is a very good player. But he, now that he has switched legions, you know, I mentioned in a thing I did for today, there will be very keen interest in his progress from both sides of the Irish Sea. And a lot of people monitoring it will want him to fail on the international level just so they can go, oh, I told you so. I'm not one of them, but there are a lot who will want him to do badly.
If in 10 years there's still a furore about Declan Rice, then we've had a pretty relaxing decade. I would suggest things have gone pretty well, considering Ben asked.
Did I mispronounce furore? I think I
did. Did I mispronounce it?
I can't remember. I've now totally lost confidence.
In your furores?
Yeah.
I quite liked it, whether it's right or wrong.
Do you know what? I'll check the below-the-line comments, because that's always a good thing to
that's
do.
Definitely Let a good idea. Ben says, hey, Max, do you think this England squad could win the Premier League with a bit of luck? Well, I obviously think we can win everything. But Lars, you've probably got a more sensible mind. Where would England finish in the Premier League? I'd say you can clone players.
Yeah. Top four, I think they could do. I'm not sure they'd win it.
All right, fair enough. There you go, Ben. Republic of Ireland, Barry. Qualifiers against Gibraltar on Saturday, Georgia on Tuesday, Denmark and Switzerland also in the group. How excited are you?
I'm very excited. Group D, I've discovered all five teams can qualify.
Okay.
For the finals. So, say if Ireland and Gibraltar finish first and second, okay, which is unlikely but possible, Denmark, Georgia and Switzerland are all in Nations League playoffs, so they could go through that way. So all five teams could go through. Again, it's quite unlikely. My main thought when this group was drawn was, oh God, fucking Denmark again. no offence to the Danes. I'm sure they were thinking the same, having to put up with Ireland's turgid stuff. But it's...
At least Denmark win those games.
Mick McCarthy, obviously back in charge. They should come second in the group. They may not. They have been dire for the last year. The last year of the Martin O'Neill reign was just awful. They lost games. I think they only won 1 in 9 in the last calendar year. So expectations are quite low. Mick McCarthy has done well as Ireland manager in the past, and you know he left Ipswich, and you know he didn't like the fans and they didn't like him. They didn't like his style of play. You know, now they're bottom of the championship. So, you know, he had that team punching above his weight. And the hope now is he can get Ireland punching above the weight.
And remind me the situation. He's there until...
Till the end of this campaign. And then your man from Dundalk, Stephen Kenny, who left Dundalk to take over the Irish 21s, he's kind of been groomed as Mick's successor. But... You know,
but what if Mick is successful?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I don't know. Foresight is not one of the Football Association of Ireland's great gifts.
That's a very odd way of doing it, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Were they so certain that Mick McCarthy wouldn't be that successful that they felt that this is something they can set up?
You're asking me to analyse the collective mind of those in charge of the Football Association of Ireland. They've just been relentlessly issuing statement after statement after statement this week, each one failing to make this mysterious bridging loan of 100 grand that John Delaney gave his own employers a couple of years ago, you know, failing to make it any more clear and just muddying the waters.
So I mean, there's a chance what they're trying to do is create, you know, a progression strategy. You know, that's how you'd view it, wouldn't you? A sort of idea that the, you know, the Irish DNA that you could build.
Yeah, I just think Mick McCarthy has to be happy with his role in that strategy. If Ireland do qualify, then surely he's going to want to continue. My worry with... We've played Ireland so much over the last few years. My concern with Ireland is that you seem to have very few young players. So whenever we've played you, the average age of your side's been quite old, and I don't know who the talented... The Irish equivalents of the Harry Wilsons and the Ben Woodburns and the David Brookses are...
Nobody seems to know who they are.
Yeah, you don't have
I'm not even sure if they exist.
You don't have many young players or many good players. So that aside, yeah, you're fine.
I suppose there's a certain logic to the Stephen Kenny thing, because as a manager, I mean, he's done great work with Dundalk, obviously. I think any manager who can make a League of Ireland team hold their own to any degree in the Europa League surely has to have something about him. Of course, the transition from club management to international management can be very difficult, because the idea of only having a couple of weeks a year to get your points across, you know, it's a different way of coaching, it's a different way of treating people. So giving him a taste of that with the under-21s for a while before putting him in charge of the national senior team, there's a certain logic there. And there's also a logic that if he manages to find some very promising young players in the under-21s, he can take them with him. I just think it's one of those, like you say, if Mick McCarthy is successful, it gets really awkward, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. Some very sad news about the Sky Sports News reporter Fraser Robertson. News that came out yesterday, really shocking. Died at the age of just 47. He was the journalist who broke the news about Roy Keane being sent home from the Ireland training camp at the 2002 World Cup in Japan. Lots of lovely comments coming in from people who knew him, people who worked with him. But obviously our thoughts with his family and friends. And that'll do for part one. We'll start part two discussing Scotland.
It's time to focus.
They rush the baby to the hospital, and that's when they start accusing Imelda. They say, well, you tried to kill your daughter.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Richard writes, possible shout out for me. Hello, Richard. I've been listening from a town called Kandy in Sri Lanka for almost 10 years now. Still hoping you might do a live show here one day. As yet, no live shows planned for Sri Lanka, but if you know any tour promoters, we'll go anywhere. On the 22nd of April, we are going to Glasgow, Barry, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Me, you and Murray and Jonathan Wilson for an extended Fitbar Corner. Come to that. And then on the 23rd of April, Lars.
Yes.
You're joining us in Belfast.
I am.
At Elmwood Hall.
Should be great.
Subbing out Wilson, bringing in you, me, Barry, and Ewan doing both. Please come along because they'll be fun, like Hackney was on Friday. Yes, Lars?
I mean, I've noticed that night we are up against Madagascar the Musical in the Belfast night scene.
Well,
starring winner of X Factor 2016, Matt Terry.
Okay.
Which, that's tough competition, unless there's something. Unless there's something you guys haven't told us, we don't have an X Factor winner.
Well,
we won't.
You can really hold a note, Matt Terry.
Can we get Owen Quigg? I believe he did all right, and he's, you know.
So, I mean, if you are in Belfast and you're desperate to move it, as it were, maybe Madagascar the Musical is the place to go. But I think our show will be, well, there'll be more football inside, probably.
Well, you know how on the live shows, I always wanted us to do a synchronised dance, dance number, and we never get round to it. Maybe this is the time.
I feel like I made a huge mistake just bringing this up.
Do you know any songs from Madagascar? You've got Children, Ellis. Do you know the Madagascar songs?
No, she's not quite old enough for Madagascar.
Oh, really? Yet. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Isn't the Move It song from there?
I want to move it, move
I
it.
I think that's there. What? I think that's from...
I literally have no idea what you're talking about.
Who sang
about?
I Want to Move It, Move It?
As in,
was that Innie Kamosi?
As in, I like to move it.
Yeah, that's not from Madagascar. That's from the 90s.
It's from Now Dance 93.
But I think it's exactly. In Madagascar, the film.
Is it?
I'm just saying
real
that.
To real. Thank you, Jonathan. What did Innie Kamosi do? Oh, here comes the hot stepper.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we could do both of them.
It
we?
Just says on the website here that Madagascar will leave audience with no choice but to move it, move it. Now, if that song is not in the show, that is an outlandish and weird thing to put on the website.
You should put exactly the same thing on your website. Guardian Football Weekly will leave the audience in no choice but to move it, move it.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Richard, one of 616 listeners in Sri Lanka, one of just two listeners in Kandy. So we could do a quite intimate gig in your living room. But I wonder,
if we do a show there, should we bring Ceylon Andy Hickman?
Oh, very good.
Because of, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, clever.
That's clever and
pretty niche, I'll say, Lars. Scotland qualifiers against Kazakhstan and San Marino to really get them excited. Belgium, Cyprus and Russia in their group as well. Andy Robertson out of the Kazakhstan game after dental surgery. And so's backup left-back Kieran Tierney with a hip problem. So the one position Scotland have two top class options and they're both out. Robertson should be back for the trip to San Marino. Going to be tricky, isn't it, to get past Belgium and Russia?
I don't know. The big question is whether Russia are actually any good, because Russia were famously terrible in the run-up to the World Cup. And then they were suddenly surprisingly and bafflingly good during the World Cup.
Dreadful in the Euros.
Yeah, so the question is now, will they revert to being terrible again? Will they still have this the great love of the motherland flowing through their veins when they go into the qualifiers here? And will they still be as surprisingly and bafflingly good as they were? If they are, Scotland have a problem, as you say, but they could also revert to pre-World Cup Russia, in which case Scotland have a chance.
I think Scotland have a very good chance of finishing ahead of Russia. They've good players. My concern for Scotland would be, and it's a blessing and possibly potentially a curse, they have the Nations League playoff safety net or get-out-of-jail card, whatever you want to call it. And I'm worried the players will develop a mindset where they don't treat the qualifiers with enough urgency because they're aware they have this safety net to fall back on. And Alex McLeish really needs to make sure that that doesn't happen, and whether he will be able to or not, because he is renowned, but perhaps unfairly, according to Ewan Murray, you know, quite the kind of guy who might be of that mindset as well. But he has said it won't happen, and I hope it doesn't.
Well, it's bought him some time, though, the Nations League, isn't it? Because he wasn't a particularly popular appointment.
No.
But they were very impressive in the Nations League, I thought. And, you know, they're playing Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan haven't won a home qualifier for 8 years. You know, if they don't get off to a good start, well, I just think I can't see it not happening. So, you know, a bit of bounce with 6 points.
It is an odd group, because Cyprus, Kazakhstan, and San Marino, obviously everyone should be beaten, right? Even the away game to like Cyprus.
They can be quite tricky, Cyprus.
I think we beat them and we're Norway. And
they beat Ireland 5-2 once during the Steve Staunton regime.
Did they?
Yes.
But either way, like it's the Scotland-Russia games are going to be so like...
We played them in qualifying for Euro 2016 and we did have to huff and puff a lot against Cyprus. Play them out, beat them, was it 1-0 out in Nicosia? I think we drew 0-0 in Cardiff, but they're just tricky and difficult, and the pitch out in Cyprus is poor. And it's one of those, they're one of those countries that Scotland could find that a slightly more daunting prospect than you'd think. But if they don't beat Kazakhstan and San Marino, then they've got big problems.
Now, Aberdeen fullback Shay Logan, he has some form of not particularly liking Celtic. When they lose, he sort of tweets crying with laughter emojis. In one game after the Aberdeen striker Sam Cosgrove was sent off, Logan appeared to for a crunching tackle on Scott Brown. In the aftermath, Logan appeared to kick a ball at Scott Brown on telly. Brown said, "We Logan did a runner right after it, as he usually does." So what did Shay Logan's friends do? On his stag do, they made him dress as Scott Brown. So he was in full Celtic kit for his stag do, which is a lovely touch, isn't it? Adam says, after Aberdeen Shay Logan was made to dress as Scott Brown, his stag do, what are some of the best worst stag efforts the pod have witnessed?
I think I've mentioned this before in the pod, but my mate Alex's best man puking in his helmet while driving a go-kart around a track on the morning after.
The worst way to drown, surely.
Yeah, so you just see the vomit gradually rising through the visor.
Oh, dear.
My favourite is a friend, I may have mentioned this on the pod as well, who made everybody on the stag do, not just the groom, dress as goths. And then they went out in Camden, so nobody cared. So
yeah,
they were all incredibly self-conscious.
You should have gone out in Kettering. Yeah,
exactly. But the idea was they're sitting there going, "Oh, we feel ridiculous." But everyone was just like, "All right." All that effort. Anyway, Northern Ireland qualifies against Estonia on Thursday, Belarus on Sunday. Group C also has Germany and Holland. So what chance do we give them?
You're basically relying on either the Netherlands or Germany to be a complete car crash. And with the Dutch looking slightly resurgent and surely the Germans can't mess it up that badly. It doesn't look great.
Luckily for Northern Ireland, it is very likely that they'll make the playoffs through the Nations League. So they'll be in the playoffs if 16 of the 20 automatic qualifiers come from Nations League, sort of come from the Nation League pots A and B, and as they're the top teams, that shouldn't be too big an ask. I read that, to put it another way, unless five teams from League C or D seal automatic qualification, Northern Ireland will get a playoff spot. So they've been hugely unlucky to be drawn in this group of death with Germany and Holland, but they do have a backdoor route, fingers crossed.
Although, as Barry's already pointed out, Gibraltar are going to qualify top of that group.
I didn't say that. I said they could qualify. It is possible.
Is that your real persona or your anti Lorraine Kelly persona?
the persona you tell the HMRC that you have.
The other friendly last night, Germany and Serbia played out a one-all draw. Germany named a young side as they move on from the Müller, Hummels, Boateng era. Leroy Sané, who was left out of the World Cup squad, had to be taken off in the 96th minute after an absolute filthy tackle from Milan Pavkov, who was sent off. Pavkov, who was the player who scored both goals when Red Star beat Liverpool 2-0 in November, came off the bench to make his debut just 22 minutes before that. How do we view Germany? I saw Jürgen Klinsmann saying we're on the floor in the week, and Jürgen loves saying, I've got to do this by myself, Lars.
I think it's a little bit strange for Jogi Love to not just drop these guys of the old guard, but just seemingly closing the door on them completely. I don't quite see the need to be that absolutist in it. He could have said, listen, you're not playing that well at the moment. We want to move in a different direction. And you leave the door open for them to rediscover their form. And
they're not even
then you
old.
Can bring them back. Because it's you risk the Steve McLaren, David Beckham thing when you made a big statement and then things go wrong and then you sort of have to embarrassingly bring them back again at some point. I mean, that you don't want to put yourself in that position. I think there are some sort of younger guys in this squad that are exciting. But it looks a bit stale, and the newer guys, like you're looking, so sort of Serge Gnabry and Max Eggstein, and it's sort of these guys aren't quite at the level you need them to be at just yet. So it's a generational shift, if you will, going on.
More on Leroy Sané, and we obviously hope he's okay. This is from Bild. Says Leroy Sané kam am Montag mit einem 25.000 Euro outfit. He arrived at the team hotel with a coat that cost 4,500 euros and a Louis Vuitton backpack that cost 18,000 euros. And I mean, it looks like a school. I'm not an expert, I'll be honest, but I think 18,000 euros for that rucksack seems steep.
Steep. It's not even practical. It's not even that big. Get a sleeping bag in.
Do you when you purchase bags, you're paying for volume, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I could move house using my rucksack.
That's quite extra. 18,000 for a bag. I mean, I suppose it's not even a day's wages, is it, for Leroy? Anyway.
The thing that makes me wonder, I mean, Manuel Neuer started against Serbia. I mean, what does he have to do to get dropped? Like, he hasn't been very good this season. And Love just seems... I mean, Ter Stegen did come on against Serbia, but the idea that he's... If you're shoving some guys out, if you're saying, listen, old guard dudes, you need to go away because we want to try someone else, how on earth is Manuel Neuer not on that list of people you're sending away?
Well, I suppose
he's
run
been
as much,
not great for quite a while now.
Yeah, you know, you're just standing still, aren't you, Lars?
What?
There.
No, but he's not saving the shots. Okay. Like if you look
you
at
goalkeeping, so very simple.
You know, if you look at
just
his,
save the shots.
No, but if you look at his numbers for Bayern this season, they're atrocious. Whereas Ter Stegen has been really, really good for Barcelona. So, and he wasn't good at the World Cup, and it's very odd. I don't. If you're gonna force through this sort of changing of the guard, how he survives, I don't understand.
Is Oliver Kahn still there or thereabouts?
No.
Okay.
Jens Lehmann, if you're going to bring back someone, get Mad Jens involved. I was just reading about him the other day, and he had a sort of loopiness about him that I feel like modern football lacks. I think there are too many squares in modern football. It's too hard. We need like proper sort of Jens Lehmann. You know that time he nicked an opponent's player's shoe? That was really good. Just sort of weirdness like that. Bring
Maybe,
Jens Lehmann back.
Although of all the footballing cliches, the idea that all goalkeepers are crazy, I find it sort of annoys me a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all comes from Bruce Grobbelaar's spaghetti legs in the 84 European Cup. I've never met a goalkeeper though. Oh, my God.
Like David Seaman, I spend some time with, seems quite normal. Mark Schwarzer, I work with occasionally, quite normal.
Yeah. I've met Asmir Begovic, and he was quite normal. Ben Foster could not be more normal.
I met Rob Green, totally normal bloke who's doing an MA in business studies.
Paul Robinson is a pretty normal, normal man as well.
Bodo Ilgner never worried me.
Jussi Jaskalainen has an edge.
Does he?
A sinister edge.
Hans van Breukelen. Steer clear from him.
Anyway, for some reason, producer Jonathan is doing the wind this section up.
Oh, come on. I want to work through all of my 80s and 90s goalkeepers. Walter Zenger.
Eric Torstvedt is a lovely fella.
Is he?
Is he?
Yeah, he's good. He does TV in Norway now and very good at it too.
Okay, punctual, normal.
Yeah, very sort of...
I love the Neville Southall rebrand.
Oh, that's good, yes.
On Twitter.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think that's crazy. It's more emotionally intelligent.
No, you're right. He's emotionally intelligent, whereas Peter Shilton has gone full Rees Mogg, hasn't he?
Oh, dear.
It's like the hardest of hard Brexits is Shilts. Anyway, changes to the Champions League. A Wall Street Journal has reported that UEFA and European Club Association held a meeting this week to discuss reforms to the Champions League. Ideas include promotion and relegation that would replace the current qualifying structure, 4 of 32 teams relegated out of the competition every year, matches being moved from midweek to the weekend, more matches for all teams. This is just a Super League, isn't it?
Yep.
And what are we...
We're so worried about the big clubs going off to form their own Super League that we're making one for them, I guess.
UEFA called it just an informal brainstorming session. I hope that's how they...
exercises.
I have to stand up, introduce themselves, and say one thing about yourself for this.
Can we just talk about how depressing it is? Like, I mean, they're not, these things haven't gone through. It's just ideas that are being floated. But good God, like, if it's one of those, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And I don't understand how you can look at the current European club scene and see, you know what the problem is here? Life is too hard for the wealthiest clubs. We need to make it easier for them. I mean, how is that the conclusion you can draw out of this?
Or we need more football matches. That's surely not a conclusion either. I mean,
what they seem to have forgotten is that the vast majority of clubs have no presence or interest in the Champions League. And the vast majority of football fans don't support clubs who are in the Champions League. And as much as I love watching the final stages of the Champions League, you know, I don't really care because the Swans aren't in it.
Mm. But you still consume it, right?
Well, I consume it.
In the UK, the Champions League TV audience is negligible because people either don't want or can't afford BT Sport. And that's the only place it is. And before there's a stampede to Twitter in the comment section going, oh, well, you could stream it or you can watch highlights on YouTube. That's not the same. There are a lot of people out there who would like to watch Champions League football who don't know how to stream stuff, who, you know, aren't computer savvy. And, you know, it's a negligible TV audience here. Pitiful.
So there are problems with the current... So when I say don't, if it's not broke, don't fix it, I mean, I'm lying slightly. There are issues with the current financial model of the Champions League because it has massively skewed some of the smaller leagues around Europe. If you have one team that routinely makes the group stage, then every other team in that division
TNS
are completely doomed.
Yeah.
So that is something I wish someone could look at. But at least there's a logic in a merit it's meritocratic in the sense that you play in your local country league, and if you do really well there, you get to go to a continental league. There's a meritocracy to that that I kind of like. The idea of just making that more of a closed shop, just so that the biggest clubs that are already really wealthy and have already completely sort of destabilized European football, to make it even easier for them to make even more money, is completely ridiculous. That is not what the sport needs at all.
But do you think it will happen? I mean, like when do you think there'll be a European Super League with? Because it has been talked about
for years.
I mean, yeah. Since I was 10, I reckon.
Yeah.
And it hasn't happened, so I sort of cling to the hope.
Hopefully, never.
It was a thing that was discussed quite a lot in the late 90s, wasn't it? Because there was, what was that breakaway group of European super clubs? Because Liverpool were involved, even though they hadn't won the league and they hadn't won the European Cup for years. They were involved because of their historical prestige. Certainly, you know, I'm your age and I remember this being discussed when I was at school. I think, to be honest, National League setups are too popular in their respective countries for it to happen. But I think it's a terrible idea, so I really hope that that is the case.
Well, the European Club Association started as the G14.
That was the G14.
Now they're an organisation that theoretically includes all the clubs, but it's mainly like an interest group for the biggest clubs. And they now have seats on the UEFA Executive Committee. Which is, you know, the very definition of letting the wolf into the hen house, I believe.
Mm. Has anyone gone to the wrong meeting? Because, you know, the G7 and the G21 are sort of hugely vital international governing, you know, countries.
But there's a serious point here. Like, obviously the wealthiest clubs in the world want to make even more money and want to protect their business model. But the whole point of UEFA and the all other governing bodies that they're meant to, like, consider what's actually good for the game. And it doesn't seem like they're capable of doing that anymore, which is depressing.
In other Champions League news, this from Andy Mitten, the editor of the United We Stand fanzine. The €120 that Barcelona are charging Manchester United fans at the Nou Camp is the most expensive ticket in Manchester United's history outside of the final. Manchester United are now going to increase the cost of Barcelona's tickets at Old Trafford to €120 and use the difference to subsidise ticket prices for travellers to the Nou Camp down to £75. Which is that? Is that a good thing? Sounds, or is it tit for tat thing? I can't. Either way,
well,
fans
it's good PR for Manchester United. Their fans won't get rinsed quite as much as they would have been, but it's all pretty unseemly, whatever way you look at it, isn't it?
You're getting rinsed, so we'll rinse you too.
Well, there's a whole lot of rinsing going on.
Mm. But the relief is that Barcelona are, as we know, more than a club. And I've read their website on this, and they say, we're more than a club because we feel that such values as humility, ambition, effort, teamwork and respect are just as important a part of the way we play as winning. That's why we are more than a club, because we spend every day working hard to be the best and to make the world a better place by not only imagining a more prosperous future, but by really making it happen. I guess that's expensive stuff, and you need to fleece travelling English fans in order to achieve these lofty goals.
Thank you, Lars. A couple of important things. Chelsea have complained about racist abuse in Kiev. Callum Hudson-Odoi told captain Cesar Azpilicueta during the match, then club officials after the match, that he'd heard monkey chants. A statement from Chelsea: we can confirm a report of racist abuse directed at one of our players in the final minutes of the match in Kiev from a small section of home supporters. We wholeheartedly condemn such abhorrent behaviour. We expect UEFA to conduct a thorough investigation. We'll provide full cooperation. And from the Football League, Bolton Wanderers have been given 2 weeks to settle their debts, namely an unpaid £1.2 million tax bill, or risk going into administration. The High Court hearing was the sixth time in 16 months that Bolton have faced a winding up petition. Owner Ken Anderson claims he's agreed terms with a buyer who will pay off their debts. Players and staff were paid February's wages late. So we very much hope it is sorted out at Bolton. And you think it just wasn't long ago that they were in the FA Cup semi-final. Who was there? Gary Cahill was there. They had Sturridge on loan. Owen Coyle, manager, playing nice football.
The Bolton owner, Ken Anderson, is horrendously unpopular with his own club's fans. He has been warned by the police, or advised by police, not to go to games because they're genuinely concerned about his safety. He's very unpopular with his club's staff, players, coaching staff, and the problem seems to be that he values the club too high, It's pretty much worthless because it's so in debt. But he, so various people are trying to buy it from him. He won't sell because he's holding out for a price that he is never realistically going to get. So I would take his latest comments with a pinch of salt, to be honest.
Fair enough. And that's how we'll end part two. In part three, we'll begin chatting to Susie Rack about the events in women's football. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Lots of news from the women's game, so let's catch up with Susie Rack, women's football correspondent for The Guardian. How are you doing, Susie?
I'm good, thanks.
First of all, let's start with the good news, shall we? This Barclays sponsorship deal, on the face of it, seems like very positive for the women's game.
Yeah, it's a massively important deal. I think it's a big landmark in the growth and the progression of women's football. The fact that it's a £10 million or over £10 million deal shows that, you know, women's football is no longer seen as just a cheap option for sponsors, good bit of image promotion, and for very low expense. But it shows that brands are recognising that it is a growing force. Then obviously you've got the actual benefits of that money itself, the fact that you've got a big portion of it going into grassroots, into schools, and then the first ever prize fund for the Women's Super League, which, you know, it kind of sounds crazy that it's been zero for any finishing in any position in the league, including winning it. The structure is a little bit different to Premier League in that the teams all get grants from the FA for being in the league. So they've had that, but they've never really had any kind of incentive to do well in the league, and this changes that a bit.
Okay, well, that is interesting. To have no prize money at all does seem unbelievable,
yeah,
doesn't
zero,
it?
Yeah, zero to half a million, yeah.
And also from Spain, that the biggest ever crowd in the history of women's football, 60,739 turning up for Atletico Madrid Barcelona.
Yeah, it's a huge crowd, the biggest in 99 years, we think, which would be the Ditka ladies game at Goodison Park the year before the FA's ban came in. So it's taken that long for us to just kind of get back to that level of attendance. It's obviously that's in Spain, and situation in Spain and the UK is different, the culture is different, you know, they clubs are very reliant on regionalism there, and they're able to play into that very effectively. But they also marketed that campaign incredibly well. They had buses going around the city with faces on, they had the players signing t-shirts in stores in the weeks before, they had plaques unveiled for all the players that have hit 100 caps, so they did a huge amount of work for it. It's good a good marker, an example of what kind of we need to do in the WSL to boost attendances.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, I guess, the British game can learn from that, right?
Definitely. I think, you know, kind of one of the big problems that I see is that there's a very marketing-led mentality to the way we build for games. You know, focus on social media, we focus on kind of getting some pretty posters up on billboards and things like that, and there might be a few free tickets to schools, but if anything, in my mind, you keep kind of need a bit more of an activist led, for want of a better word, a bit more of a campaigning strategy for actually getting people into the ground. You need to be a bit more in their face, and I think that's what Atletico did really well in the build-up. They were kind of out there, they put a lot of money clearly into getting in your faces and getting it known that this game was big, and once it was getting closer and closer to being sold out, I think that helped then sell those final tickets, because it meant that people wanted to be a part of it, people wanted to pay attention to it. And yeah, I mean, on top of the 60,000, they got 400,000 watching on the telly as well, so yeah, hugely kind of inspirational for I presume every team and every league around the world at the moment.
Story that came out yesterday, the Spurs centre-back Renee Hector had accused Sheffield United women's forward Sophie Jones of making monkey noises at her during a game. Sophie Jones denied the charge. She's been given a 5-match ban by the FA. She's since left her club. Renee Hector tweeted, "There's no place for racism in our game. A zero-tolerance policy is imperative in stamping this out from football. I welcome the verdict." Sophie Jones said, "The hearing took place in a kangaroo court. So with a heavy heart, I feel I'm unable to continue within football and play under an organisation I do not have any confidence in. I'd like to state on record I do not condone racism in any form. I'll continue to stand by this statement." What have you made of the story?
Yeah, it's a hard one to judge. I mean, I think it's extremely good that the FA and Sheffield United have taken a very hard stance on this. Obviously, we don't know the details of the case, so comment on Sophie Jones's statement about whether the FA have kind of pushed through this regardless of the evidence is impossible for us to say at the moment. Obviously, you can never completely trust the FA to not balls up an investigation, but at the same time, you know, I think they should be applauded for kind of for pushing this through and being quite hardline on it. And I think it says a lot that the club have cancelled their contract straight away. It means it's very difficult for her to find another club. I mean, the 5-game ban would have taken her within one game of the season ending anyway. So I'm guessing that if she signs with anywhere else, that 5-match ban would be in place there. So, it does essentially end her career. She's obviously, I assume, got the right to appeal it. And if she feels that strongly about it, she should. Yeah, it's good that the hard line's been taken, but if there's more to it, I'm sure that will come out.
Susie, I don't think the FA should be applauded. I think they've handled this quite badly. Now, I'm not a legal expert, but Sophie was found guilty based on probability. And the FA have said written reasons in the case will be published in due course. Why couldn't they delay the verdict until these written explanations were available? Because
this girl,
her reputation and her career, I don't know how much she earns as a Sheffield United player, are both on the line, and she's now been left in this weird limbo. She's adamant it didn't happen. I don't know whether it did or it didn't, but, you know, why not give us the written reasons now rather than in due course, whenever that may be?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very valid point. And there's also, I mean, the timing of it is particularly either strategic or foolish, in that it's ahead of Tottenham playing Sheffield United this weekend, which, you know, I think is not a good thing, obviously. And I think, you know, we should have the full details of the case. I'd completely agree with you on that. But, you know, at the same time as feeling some sympathy towards Sophie Jones's statement, I just can't see a reason why Renee would have made it up either. So it's a very hard one to judge. The FA always makes some mistakes. I'm just glad that some action has been taken over it. I completely agree. They should release the findings when they release the verdict.
On the pitch, Chelsea PSG in the Champions League tonight. Chelsea, the only English team left in the competition.
Yeah, so Man City went out to Atletico Madrid in the last 32. So that's the kind of furthest back they've fallen in recent years. And so Chelsea kind of last man standing. And they've got a decent chance. PSG are a decent team, but they're no Lyon, who kind of walk the league and virtually walk the Champions League, having won it for the past 5 years. So, you know, they've got a strong team, Chelsea. They've got a lot of players who have just come back from injury. Malin Mjelder just stepped back into defence or midfield. Christian Payne either. And she was such a crucial cog in their double-winning campaign last season. And Dan Kirby's firing again, you know, hat-trick midweek, a week and a half ago. She's scoring again. They've got every opportunity of progressing to the next round, which would obviously be a good thing. Another thing of the sponsorship deal is that hopefully it should help close the gap on the very, very top teams like Lyon and Wolfsburg a little bit too.
And finally, how much are you looking forward to players in the Women's World Cup doing the TV charade for VAR? Have they just announced that it's going to be in place for the World Cup in France?
it's good they've got it because I think particularly in the Champions League final, it was a big complaint that there was no VAR whilst the men's game had it. So it's good that that's being recognised, whether it is used to its best effect and makes any sense is another thing. But at least it's equal.
Listen, Susie, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
No worries. Cheers.
Susie Rack there, women's football writer from The Guardian. In other news, Paris Saint-Germain have condemned comments made by Patrice Evra on social media following Manchester United's 3-1 win in Paris, where he used homophobic epithets Lars, he did apologise in a manner of speaking.
In the genre of non-apology apologies, it was a particularly spectacular entrance into that genre. Can I read this out? I'm not homophobic because you know who I am. I'm Mr. Love This Game. I love everyone. If I offended someone or I hurt someone, I really apologise, but it's not my intention. They, the French media, are just trying to put me down. I stand for equality. You have to be free, whatever you do in life. I would never judge anyone. My mum raised me and educated me that way. And you know what? Only God can judge me. So he's doing the, if I caused offence, I apologise for that. And actually, you know what? Only God can judge me, and is really the French media's fault anyway. So there's that.
PSG said, we strongly condemn Patrice Evra's homophobic insults aimed at us, our representatives and former players on social media. I suppose a sad state of affairs when you say about someone they'd be better off just licking raw chicken on social media, which is what he did do before.
Yeah. Remind me who PSG are owned by. And that regime's views on
it's a laudable stance.
Homosexuality.
We are in a very strange dimension when the soft power vehicle for the Qatari government is basically lecturing us on homophobia. It's a good stance for them to take, but you know, also look closer to home, lads.
Mm. In other Paris Saint-Germain news, the Court of Arbitration for Sport has upheld their appeal against an attempt by UEFA investigators to reopen a previously closed investigation about FFP. UEFA initially found PSG compliant with FFP rules, wanted to review their decision. That's been shut down as CAS ruled that UEFA missed their deadline. There's been a video doing the rounds of Australian referee Jared Gillett doing his last game in the A-League. He's mic'd up in a 4-1 win for Western Sydney over Brisbane Roar. He's moving to the UK to take a position as a postdoctoral researcher in children with cerebral palsy at John Moores University in Liverpool. We'll be reffing in the Championship from next season. And Barry, it was eye-opening, and it just seemed very nice compared to the Tony Adams v. David Ellery video of 40 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, he's clearly a good referee, and he clearly had the respect of the players involved. I think there was one who was congratulating him on his move to England and saying, you know, you're one of the better referees, while getting his name taken for a booking, I think. And the one thing I'd note, you know, people have been saying, oh, we need that here in the Premier League. Now, I don't think the comments he was making and the players were making were audible throughout the game. It was something that came out after. But the one thing I noticed is that when, say, he was consulting with his linesman over a possible offside or something, there was no players crowding around him and badgering him and harassing him and effing and jeffing in his face. I don't know if that's just an A-League thing or an Australian thing, or because they knew he was mic'd up, they were behaving themselves or making an extra effort to behave themselves. So I would imagine a similar thing in England. In the Premier League, there will be 10 players surrounding a referee and a linesman, all pleading their cases with various degrees of profanity. And yeah, it was interesting, but I'm not sure it achieves very much, really. It's just, if it was introduced here, it would just focus even more attention on referees, and I think we need to focus far less on them.
Can you imagine how much Mike Dean would love it?
Oh, yeah.
Mike Dean.
I'm convinced he's going for Strictly. I mean, I'm absolutely convinced.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't watch it anyway.
Putting the ball up his shirt and all that kind of thing. And then, who was it he sent off? And he said, off you pop.
Yes, oh, you know, that's terrible, isn't it?
Off you pop.
Henry says, could a midfield of Cantona, Letizia and Gascoigne be successful today if they had Kante behind them? I mean, they'd be pretty good, I guess, if they're fully fit. But on Letizia, did anybody watch Harry's Heroes? Has anyone seen the documentary?
No.
I watched it, and Harry Redknapp brings back some...
The documentary.
Some old England players. Well, it wasn't...
Hard-hitting.
No, it was... No, actually, because you
it's
you
not
joke.
Adam Curtis,
I'm sure
is it?
I'm sure it's great.
No, but you joke, but there are some really serious parts of it about sort of middle-aged men and how much they weigh and how dangerous for their health. And there's a very moving bit with Paul Merson, who obviously I know really well, about it was filmed in August and he breaks down in a taxi sort of saying his, you know, they had the old footage of when he'd, you know, when he had that press conference in Arsenal and sort of same again in the back of a taxi sort of saying the gambling's taken control again. And I, like Lars, thought this would be just, you know, sort of a merry, banter-filled bit of nonsense. And there was a lot of that, Razor Ruddock sort of being the forefront of that. But actually, it had some really moving moments in it, and ones with Merce and then ones with Razor Ruddock about his health. You know, he goes through a medical check with his wife. They're saying, listen, you are at risk of, you know, having a heart attack and heart disease and things like that. And I would, yeah, just recommend people watch it. Merce is doing much better now, by the way, which is a good thing.
They sacrifice so much. So many footballers, when they retire, are so desperate to have a good time. Mm. That is when they become alcoholics, which you can understand.
True. Although the footballers of this era were doing it at the same time. A lot of them were doing
Ruddock
it at the same
especially.
Time. But I think, you know, footballers do, and I've had this conversation with so many of them, they find it impossible. I think Tony Cotty was saying, it's the idea of one of those fire escapes where you push the door to get out and it slams behind you and you can't get back in. And how can you recreate everyone singing your name? You just can't. The highs that you get at 28 or 29, you've got so much life to live.
And also, no one is ever interested in talking to you about what you're doing now.
No.
They are only ever interested in a snapshot of your life, age between 20 and 33. And that could be the case when you're 73. Like,
Ellis, you have more or less given up doing live stand-up comedy, have you?
Yeah, for the moment.
And do you miss it?
Absolutely not at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no.
See, because
of the lifestyle.
A smaller scale thing, yeah, it's a horrible lifestyle, but when, you know, to have an audience in the palm of your hand everyone laughing at you, you must miss that a little. Because you don't get reaction from your radio show or any podcast you're on or
with TV
shows.
The thing, I had children, and for 10 years I drove 25,000 miles a year up and down the country, and I ate in service stations, and I did love it, but it can get you down after a while. With footballers, I do Fighting Talk on 5 Live quite a lot, and you talk to a lot of athletes, and a few of them have said to me, it is just, you know, they've all got stuff going on in their 40s and 50s, but no one is interested. Mm. It's a bit like with Buzz Aldrin. No one ever wants to talk to Buzz Aldrin about anything other than the moon.
But the other thing as well is whether you've given up stand-up or whatever, like, there is your peak could be when you're 70, right? I almost certainly have peaked, Barry. I mean, I'm not saying anything, but there could be a renaissance. You never know. You could... professionally, you could peak at whatever age in most careers. And the fact that you peak in that...
They find it, whenever they play those Legends games or those Masters games, what they all find difficult to cope with is that the brain says one thing and your body says something else. And I think that must be quite confronting. And so many footballers go through divorces very soon after retirement. And so many of them end up with problems with alcohol. I think we can be quite unsympathetic towards footballers because they earn so much. Mm. So you think, well, just sort yourself out. But the riches, that is still comparatively a recent thing. And there are plenty of footballers as well who are advised so poorly when they are making a lot of money, who make bad decisions and then squander their money, which is, and you have no way of
18,000 euro rucksacks.
Well, yeah. Someone should take him to one side and say, just don't buy it. Yeah. It's a shit rucksack.
I interviewed Jamie O'Hara about that, actually. And because he obviously had a celebrity wife, and then he did the whole OK magazine, and he did all that without really thinking, and now looks back and goes, what the hell was I doing? You know, this whole world that's completely ridiculous. And it must be so easy to just fall down. Go down that path without really even considering it. And you don't get any sympathy if you...
No.
You need good people around you to give you a kick in the arse and go, look, don't buy an 18 grand rucksack. You don't need an 18 grand rucksack. You don't need to be in Hello Magazine. You know, just concentrate on your football.
Finally, Adam says, another Brexit rundown would be good. Really filled in the gaps last time. Boys for Pele does say, in the event of no deal, will Lars Sivertsen be in the business of importing Scandinavian toilet rolls for top shillings?
Well, in the case of no deal, I might not be in any business. So we'll see how that one pans out.
In which, can I have 12 quilted, please? That's my order. Barry, what toilet roll order do you want from... Because it'll be made out of some great Norwegian tree. How do they make paper?
What?
How do you make toilet roll? Comes out of trees, right? It's got to, hasn't it?
have no idea.
The way you said what, then.
I'm just interested to know.
What?
I just don't understand the direction this thing is taking.
We're just, it's the, it, I, it's the yogurt pots for hats. Last question to the pod.
I'm considering stocking up on canned goods, okay. Not just for myself, but in the event of some sort of barter economy that might break out. I've noticed that there are more adverts for Spam now than there used to be. I mean, I think maybe they're sensing that this is their moment. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
A lot of adverts for Spam going around.
Oh, God. Anyway, listen, that'll do for today. Ellis, thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Barry.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.